Great, thank you. So this is a scallop aquaculture session here we're going to be having this morning, talking about efforts in Maine over the last 17 or 18 years. My name is Hugh Copperthwaite. I work for Coastal Enterprises. I work on our fisheries and aquaculture program. And we are a community development organization, and this is an effort I've been working on for a couple of years now to help move a scallop industry forward here in the state. And so our panel today are, I think you're going to be quite impressed. We've got some real champions here. I think a lot of people know these folks, but I'm just going to give a real quick intro on each of them for those of you who don't know these folks. So first off, we have Marston Brewer. He's a commercial fisherman from Stonington, and he learned about scallop efforts in Japan around 1997. He heard about local fishermen who were helping to collect wild spat and also enhance the fishery. And Marston was very instrumental in starting a project here in Maine back in the very late 90s, and Dana was part of that too, Dana Morse, collecting wild spat and getting the Maine fishing industry very engaged with that, up to 60 fishermen, I think, at one time, with an eye towards stock enhancement. And over time, it's leaning more towards an aquaculture effort. And a lot of the work was volunteer, and that's hard to maintain, but I think there's been some rekindled interest in really trying to pursue this more. So secondly, we're going to have Peter Stocks talking. Peter is the founder of Calendar Island Mussel Company. This is a mussel rope grown culture company in Casco Bay. Three lease sites, is that you? Three. And also, for the last 3 years, Peter has been doing quite a bit of work with his business partner, Dr. Mark Green, growing sea scallops. So they're using, collecting wild spat, using suspension and bottom cages, and then eventually doing grow out with a gear hanging technique, which you'll learn more about in a few minutes. And then lastly, but not least at all, is Dana Morse, who is an extension associate with the Maine Sea Grant College Program at the University of Maine and Cooperative Extension. Dana is at the Darling Center in Walpole, and he joined the extension team in 1998 and has been a real leader and great resource here in the state for helping shellfish growers and aquaculturists and fishermen, and just a great resource. So I know Dana's always been beating the drum about scallops here, and so it's good to have him here on the panel too. Just before I let these panelists speak, I just want to set the context slightly here, where a lot of what you'll hear about today is based on Japanese techniques of growing scallops. So Maine has a sister state relationship with the very northern prefecture of Japan, Aomori. As you can see, it's the northernmost prefecture on the main island of Honshu, and then you see Hokkaido just to the north there. So there was a ship that was built in Bath, Maine, in, over 100 years ago, and it wrecked off the coast of Aomori in a typhoon in 1889. And that incident really started this connection with this part of Japan. And about 20 years ago, Maine sort of formalized this Maine sister state relationship So we have the Maine Amore Sister State Advisory Council, and then the Friends of Amore, these are both nonprofit groups that are helping to, exchange with this part of the world. There's been numerous exchanges over the last 20 years between Maine and Japan. There was one in 1999 that focused on the scallop industry, so that really sort of kicked off all of the work that you will see today. So it stems back to 17 or 18 years ago. I had the opportunity to visit in 2010 and really took a great interest in the scallop industry and just trying to, really get that going here in Maine. We do have another trip planned for the fall of this year, 2016, in October, where we'll be taking a group of Maine growers to Japan for about a week to learn firsthand as much as we can absorb in that time frame. So that's the context I just wanted to cover. I'm going to be quiet now and let our panelists go, and then if we have time at the end, I have a couple of videos that might be fun to watch for a minute. So, Marston, would you like to come up here?
Okay, thanks, you. Okay, I'm here to focus on the fishing part of it, spat collection. You said stat from the beginning, so I guess it will. With most of your species, settlement and recruitment are probably the two most important words. And oceanography plays a big part in that. When you're looking for abundance and stuff, most species will spend part of their life in the larval stage. And they'll be in the water column. For scallops, it's like 38 days. The greatest competition in life is for a piece of this earth to hold on to. It don't matter whether it's a grain of wheat, or in Kansas fighting with a weed for a little bit of sunshine, or two lobstermen on the coast of Maine looking to get close to a rock for a bed, to catch a lobster. It's that competition, that looking for a piece of earth to hold on to, is how spat collection works. We deploy spat collectors, which we'll see in a minute. Right there.
Okay. Those are 1.5 millimeter bags.
When we catch the scallops, they're only 1/4 millimeter, so they're able to swim through the bags. The material inside is called metron. It's plastic material. They go in, they attach to the abyssal thread like a muscle when they first settle. Most of it's lost either washing up on the shore or landing in, for example, the mud. Okay, if you land in the mud, you're just fodder for something else. So most of the larvae produced doesn't really turn into scallops. It's only when it finds the nursery to settle into that it stands a chance. In these bags, what we do is we provide the nursery.
Those bags, we typically catch anywhere from 1,800 to 3,500 in a bag. And we can put up to 30 bags on a line.
The ring of all the singles, there's like 200-100 pound rocks on the bottom of each line. They hold wicked hard in the tide.
Deploy the bags.
What we do is look for when scallops spawn. That took a little bit of research, but turns out in Penobscot Bay, maximum salinity is right around August 21st, and maximum salinity is one of the triggers. There's a temperature drop that goes along with it. The signals need to spawn. But when you take those two factors into account, and going up and down the bay, I'm always watching that time of year, and usually you see a weather event that it'll do is cause some mixing of the water. So you'll see the water drop three degrees real quick. Inside a week, it'll temper back out. But it's that temperature drop combined with the maximum salinity that triggers them to spawn in the wild. We use oceanography.
Well,
anyway, that's what they look like in all sizes. Just as soon as you can see them, they look like scallops. So. Let's see where he's getting. Yeah, so anyway, late September, we go like 38 days out from the 21st, so, you know, it's usually around the 21st September you try to get them in the water. You don't want to get them in the water too early because the starfish are spawning right around the same time. And even in the larval state, a scallop larvae will get eaten by a starfish larvae. So, you know, you got to be time specific and give them that clean place, but as you can see, it can be fairly successful. What we do with them, and then, okay, this is when we need. This shows what this was back in 2000. We set the bags. It was the second year we did it. And we had fishermen from all around the island, both sides of the island, up and down in. And, you know, they all went to the hot spots and, you know, looked at where they could find the scallop larvae. And it was surprising because the places where they catch the scallops, they didn't have much of a larvae. Where we did the best was on the edge of the eastern main coastal current. Probably if you just going to draw it out at the Escape Bank, Clay Bank on the south side, you know, then just blow out the hole on the north side as it's going by us. You see, the first year we only had 300 bags, and I think there was like 30 people, and everyone had 10 bags. There was 10 people, everyone had 30 bags apiece. And they were all spread out, but we had a couple of bags at Carterfield, so the next year it didn't take long for the fishermen to kind of figure out, you know, get onto it, you know, get some good numbers coming. We've got this. The spat collection pad is down. When we did it, we didn't use any fisherman's count to get the data because it wouldn't have been believable. So we had environmental group count 1 year, and we had the shore stewards group count for the next 2 years for us. That was, Dana did a lot of work there. He was quite busy that day, those days. But, I don't know, we've got the catching pad down, and now it's moving in the growing stage. Earlier in the project when we did it, you know, the idea was stock enhancement, but what we learned was that you're going to need some intermediate culture in most areas, and that extra step really makes it cost prohibitive to do on a volunteer, you know, community-type basis. So it's lent itself towards culture. Peter's the one that's doing the most work on that along with Dana, so I didn't talk to that, but it's easy to, the big stopping pad right now is we can't, you know, the memorandum of understanding to sell whole scholars is not sort of work at this time, and you need to be able to sell scallops at all the different stages. Okay, you need to be able to sell some whole scallops at that size. They got wicked spatial requirements compared to like a mussel or an oyster. You know, with an oyster, when the bag gets full, you better spread them out, put scallops along for that, or they'll smother out. So, it's, you know, waiting right now to see if we can get something worked out to really move it forward. But, you know, that's what's standing in the way of building a stable fishery right now. So, Mel, you want it back?
Yeah, right on the.
Okay, Peter's up next. You'll fill you in on the growth.
Before I start, a few things to hand out. Careful of this. These plastic hooks will get in your cloth, sweaters and wool. That's a dropper line. Here's a dropper line. Here's some examples of some of the scallops we've grown. This bag is two. The one with the deeper cut, this one that we've grown a lot of that for a while, about the same, sitting at 100 yards from other sites. The
to apologize in advance. My, I finally got over the edge on that. I started these reading glasses, so I'm just getting used to this. But, so my name is Peter Stocks, and I've been growing muscles for almost 4.5 years now. My partner in this venture is Mark Green, who's a PhD marine biologist. He's been growing mussels first for 3 or 4 years. He's been growing oysters for about 5 years. He and I got together in about 2013. He'd already been working with Dana from Marsden, I think the year prior to that, was one of the pilot groups of farmers trying to grow sea scallops. Mark's not available today, so you're stuck with me. So I just have this photograph up here as an example. I mean, these are our rafts, but behind that, imagine the rafts out there. I mean, how many hundreds of places in Maine can you see that are just like that? And that's the amount of places that scallops potentially could be grown. I'm really enthusiastic about this space in aquaculture. As Marston pointed out, there are definitely some challenges. But the species grows here. It grows well. There's no biological reason that we can't have a good fishery here. It's more the economics, the regulatory side that still needs to be worked out. So I'll just start, with sort of from the beginning a little bit. So, and I think it was 2012 and 13. We also put out some spat bags. The area that Marston is a highly successful area for collecting spat. The second most successful area, I believe, Dan will correct me if I'm wrong, is off of Cape Elizabeth down in western Casco Bay, about 4 miles offshore. Again, you have sort of the currents are outside of all the lake, Bitterford Point and Cape Elizabeth. You got converging tides. You got very deep water, about 300, 400 feet of water there in all the spots. Seems to be consistently a good place to collect spat. So I cheated. This is actually mussel larvae. But so you're looking at something that under a microscope with a power of 40, you can see like that. It wouldn't be that dissimilar in shape at that age. That's about 3 days old. And like a mussel larvae, the scallop will swim around. Mussels only for between 2 and 3 weeks. Scallops more like about a month, as Mark said, 35 to 40 days. Then they lose the ability, and they do have a similar thistle-type thread as a mussel. And once they're in the spat bags, they'll light, and they grow very rapidly, almost exponentially. They can't get out of the bag. So starting in 2014, Mark and I started growing in bags, in cages, and started experimenting with growing on ear-hanging long lines. So this is just an oyster bag. It's a 4 mil, the holes are 4 mil square. So once you catch the spat, it's western Casco Bay a little bit later. The spawning seems to be maybe 3-4 weeks later. So if you get your bags in the water late September, typically you're trying to get back to them in, say, May. And the weather's good enough, hopefully not too far into June, because you start getting lots of fowl. Once you get them out, you count them. The smaller ones will sieve a bunch. The smaller ones will go into these 4 mil bags. You have some that right out of the spat bag will go into a 9 mil bag. And this, for the very small ones, because we've tried all sorts of things. This is an array of 6 or 7 4 mil oyster bags, just to have the smaller scallops in there and grow out. We use suspension. We don't bottom grow. Mark did, I think, the first year. But in the last 2 years, we suspended it from my rafts because I have permission under my lease license, my leases, to do that. So we either suspend in the bags, suspend in cages, or we suspend on this Japanese long line that's going around it. I'll address that more in a moment. Here's an example of cages. So this is a cage with 1-inch squares. As Marsden pointed out, one of the big differences in this aspect of shellfish farming is with scallops, you have a lot more space, about 50% more space. So going forward, if people are going to try to grow in cages, it will be one of the economic challenges. You need a lot more cages than oyster farming. So you can see that those scallops are about 2 inches in length, and that density is still pretty high. We've experimented, that works, but it's actually better to have a little bit less density than that. And so I'll show you the bags, the cages, and this is the ear hanging. So that orange line that you see, we made our own lines there. We've experimented. It's very time consuming to put those little pins through that rope, it's a lot easier to buy it from Japan, or they're actually making machines that'll do it. But this was 2 years ago, and these scallops here mostly are about 3 to 3.5 inches in length. So it's called the princess size, and one of the bags has two of them in there. And there is a market for those, for live, on the half shell, referred to as a princess scallop. As Lars has mentioned already, we've been working very closely with the DMR, and this whole thing has been made possible because of Dana's hard work. We made a C grant at DMR to allow a special license. I think now starting, I'm hoping this year we'll have a commercial license for stack collection. That'll be available to anybody. On the sale side, if you're showing that there's two markets basically. There's the live on the shell, and then there's obviously the live on the shell is the one that's tenuous at this point, primarily because of red tide, because PSP, also ASP, the unlike a mussel, unlike an oyster, scallops will retain the proteins in that PSP for up to 2 or 3 years. And there's sort of, I believe there's 14 markers that make up those proteins, 4 of them, the toxic ones, and they morph. Then you go from one marker to another. So meaning, like maybe in that photograph, we send them to the lab, they test clean, we left them in the water for 6 months, eventually, you know, a healthy level of your no PSP. 6 months later, they may test hot. So this is one of the reasons that DMR is being extremely careful. I think they have about 4 years of data now, and with our meeting with them in January, it looks like they're looking for probably 10 years of data before they'll be really comfortable allowing a vibrant live sale. Having said that, there is a protocol to sell. So we did sell some of these, in 2014 in the fall when there was roe on them, and you basically have to test them 3 times, and then there's a protocol after that for testing, and each test is about $125. So it's expensive, and this goes to the margin of whether it's feasible or not. There's been a little bit of grant money in the past. Going forward, that doesn't look like that's necessarily going to be the case. But there was a very strong niche market for these. I mean, we were getting $250 a piece to a wholesaler. I know retailers are paying $253, $325. The question becomes, how big is that market? The evidence is there's certainly a very strong niche market. South of here, Massachusetts, other places are allowed to sell a live scallop. The evidence is pointing in the direction, much like a mussel, a rope grow mussel. It seems like once they're available, if they are, the supply and demand will grow. So, this is Mark. This is Mark, my partner. And these next couple photos are just about give you some idea of the labor intensity. That's another reason why we're sort of in a holding pattern here. We've been at this 2.5 years. Lars has been collecting spat for, almost 15 years, Lars, maybe a little bit longer.
Yes, this last century.
And so we feel strongly, it's early days in the grow-up, but right next to, not the site that you saw in the photograph, but one of my other lease sites, there's a natural bed where they drag in the season all day long. And so the scallops grow in this area. The salinity is perfect. There's plenty of time, there's plenty of phytoplankton for them to feed on. So the question really is, on the live side, the regulatory aspect, on the shuck side, more just the laboriousness of it, the labor intensity. And this is an example. So we're in order to, on that line that you have, each scallop, when it gets to be about 2 inches or bigger, you have to drill a hole in the rear hinge, hopefully not both of them, so you don't pierce any of the tissue, and then you slide the pairs, you slide the scallops on those hands.
Peter, you're right, but I experimented several years ago and drilled some of them. I drilled through the ear. You know, our ear's a lot smaller on our scallops. Some of them I just drilled right through both hinges, and then I ear hung them. And since I didn't have proper regulatory permits at the time, commissioner, and Colonel Fessenden knew about it. So I told him. But what I did was I put anchors on the bottom and then floats on the top, so everything was subsurface. So,
right.
And, you know, it was in an area where there was moorings and nobody was lobster fishing. And over time, I didn't see any difference between, I mean, I did a limited thing, but I didn't see any difference between the ones that I pierced both and the tissue versus the ones that I didn't.
Yeah, we've done that too. We've experimented with that too. We lost a couple, but not very many. So it does, but
obviously it's going to stress it more because you're hitting the tissue versus the shell.
To jump ahead briefly with the relationship we have with a grower in Japan, Mr. Sugiyama, who we communicate with every couple months through an interpreter, they're always adamant that you really shouldn't do that, but our experience is the same. It hasn't been very detrimental today. So the second year that we are hung, we're through MIAC, Maine Aquaculture Innovation Center, and Sea Grant, we were allowed to use this portable drill, almost like a dentist drill, and we pick up, so instead of taking sort of 10 or 20 seconds of stalk, we got it down to 8 or 9 seconds. But you can still imagine, you've got, you know, a bunch of people taking them out of tanks, handing them something, putting them back in the water because you don't want them on too long, and then you've got to actually put them on that line, and at some other point you've got to get them back out to a site and either hang them from a surface raft or, as you're saying, from long lines subsurface. This is an example of the princess-sized scallop. You can see it fouled a lot. We just taken some of the foul off to get a picture, but very nice grow. That's about a 3-inch length shell. That's probably a 30-pound meat. It's a little bit small, bigger than a bay scallop, but if you look at those shells going around, there's two in one bag. If you look at that 4-inch shell, you notice the cup is very deep. And on that 4-inch shell, you're getting a 15 to certainly between 18 and 20 pound meat, and sometimes a 15 pound meat. And that's, you know, compared to in nature, we'd probably take a 5.5-inch shell to do that. So, on the timeline, I'll just hit that briefly. So, we start in September, October, spat collection. We get into the following early May, late April, early May, and so you're emptying the bags into tanks, you're sieving into baskets for different sizes, so you have different oyster-type bags with your spat in it. We're putting them down, and then like in anything that happens in aquaculture, defouling becomes a big part of your expense and your time consumption. So these were 2-inch scallops that were floated in cages suspended from one of my mussel rafts, and as you can see, the mussel spat fouls along with tunicates, along with barnacles and everything else. Some of them literally have like an inch and a half kind of cap on them. And it comes off very easily, but again, it's very labor intense. The good news is in Japan, this is post cleaning, and as an aside, sort of density wise, I was talking about density. If you look at this, so this is a 4x3 cage. If you look at the half on the right hand side, that's about the density you can get away with oysters easily. At least what I've seen and what Mark tells me, this oyster farm. On the left-hand side, that density is still too high for scallops. If we find out, and I don't think it's the case at all, that you need to grow in cages, or people are determined to grow in cages for whatever reason, you're going to have a lot of cages. You're going to do a lot of cleaning. So this is back to when we're coming out of the spat bags, just sieving them, keeping them in water the whole time. I think I have one here to give you. There's a quarter. So this is 2 months. We get them out of the spat bags, put them into grow-up bags. About 2 months later, so we're talking now July, starting to get a little bit warm, we'll clean the bags and we'll sieve them again. So just in that amount of time, the average size has gone from under a dime size, something around a centimeter or less than a centimeter to some of them you can see are as big as a quarter. They literally almost double the size in that couple of months, the first couple of months of the spat bag. And then the slow, these are the slower growers, so they'll go down into bags within cages, or if they get to be over 2 inches, just in cages suspended. We'll clean them right through October down in Western Casco Bay. It gets cooled up by late October, and we're probably good right through the winter. We'll leave them down until about March, bring them up, and these are the slower growers from the year before. So these are nearly 2 years out of the spat bag. They've been in cages, and we've just pinned them. So that's probably almost a 3.5-inch length shell right there. As with anything with aquaculture, it's experimental. And this, I think, Marston, was that batch that we have. Some of them we get spat the first year late. Late in the season, it was our fault, not Marston, by any stretch. And a lot of fowl in the bag, and we didn't keep enough, we didn't have enough coolant, we transported them from down east down to Portland, and it wasn't quite cool enough, and we lost a lot of scallops. So that'll be another challenge in the future. If the areas to grow the spat are further away from the actual farms, you're going to be very careful. They can be transported. They typically, at the smaller
sizes can be transported for up to 12 hours out of the water, as long as they're kept moist and very cool. I put this up just to give you some sense. So I'm supposed to be talking a little bit about growth rates, and I'll just do it in general. And it matches pretty closely. There are, I think, four farms growing out there. More or less Evan and Nate and some others, and we're finding similar growth rates. Better on the long lines, but you can see how quickly some of them will grow. That one is over 4.5 inches now, so that's been out of a spat bag for a little bit under 2 years. So consistently now, we've been able to grow scallops to 4.5 inches in about 2 years. And sometimes we're getting a centimeter growth in a month. You know, down in Western Casco Bay, again, sort of late July, August, August, September, the water's the warmest. You get some phenomenal growth. You can't see the depth, but if you see the shells being passed around, that's truly the impressive part. So I end with that as far as there's two things I'm talking about on the growth. Just again, imagine that site where it's still in the winter here, we're in the cusp of the spring. There are a lot of places in Maine where scallops can be grown. And I was in this prior session for the last 30 minutes. I think this can really help the wild industry, the dragon industry. And it's one of the reasons Dana got involved in it, but it's the very primary reason that the Japanese got involved in scallop aquaculture back in the 70s was they had depleted their wild stocks to almost nothing. And they learned how to grow scallops in hatcheries and to start with aquaculture. And pre-Fukushima, pre-tsunami 2011, they were the biggest producers in the world by far, hundreds of thousands of tons of scallops per year. So we have 3,500 miles of coastline in Maine. You don't have to be where lobstermen are. You don't have to be where they drive the scallops. You could go in 20 feet of water. You could go 90 feet of water. There'll be some differences at some of the very deeper depths there, but... So it's a big potential here. I didn't speak much about the shuck market, but clearly in 2 years you can grow a scallop that will have at least a 20-pound baby, usually a 15 to 20, and they can be sold all day long for $12 a pound, $13 a pound. So it's a valuable potential fishery for the future of Maine. Maine brand is very strong. You can take these. There's some people working on marketing studies, but from my perspective and business background, the demand is there. If we can supply it, the demand is there, certainly for the shark product and most likely for the black product. In closing, in just about 2 minutes, I was asked to speak about the importance of partnerships and information and technology transfer. And this speaks directly to the project with Mori. So basically, Mars has worked extremely hard, Dan and others, but that information, whether it was management of our understanding of the ecology, the biology, that was information that came here from Japan through this sister state relationship we have with Mars. And it continues. It's taken a long time. It's been a go-slow process, I think, at many levels intentionally. And now when we're at the point where we can collect the spat, we're going to go back and see if we can figure out some ways to bring some of the mechanizing equipment back to Maine, because to truly show the feasibility of this industry, you have to do it at scale. And you can't grow ear hang at scale. You'd be drilling the holes from now until Timbuktu. Just like in anything, if you do something new, it's good to find somebody that knows, that has the information, has the background. The delegations that have come here from Omar, the delegations that Dan has been part of that have gone here, have been extremely helpful. And so I hope people will continue to support that. And I hope as a group within Maine, one thing that we've learned from the Japanese, fishermen are no different than farmers. And that's culturally something completely different than the roots from Maine. And I'm hoping as we go along that the gap in Maine, and it is closing, but will continue to close. It's a different mindset for sure. One's hunter-gatherers, one's farming. But really, we need to work together very closely. And if we do, we'll all be much better off. So those are my comments. Are there any questions? Let's go back for a second. You're waiting on
that? Michael Kursula, Department of Marine Resources. We've got two questions.
Yep.
So first, just what depth are you putting spat bags at? And then the second question would be, Right, so your scallops are a bit young when you harvest them, but they're of a size where they could breed once. Do you see the gonads going from ripe to spent at all, or have you actually witnessed any spawning at your site?
Yeah, we definitely. So first question, where we collect the spat, the water ranges between about 280 to 340 feet. The bags are only probably 50 feet off the bottom, and then we spread them out throughout that column to maybe 30 feet from the surface, 30, 40 feet from the surface. Out of Marsden, it has a lot more experience in spat collecting. How about
Yeah, we keep all our bags within about 7 fathoms of the bottom, and just use a couple of big high draw balls over them to hold them out off bottom. It's settling, so down near the bottom is probably where you're going to find it settled. The ones you're able to attach is my way of thinking.
We use the same with the hard balls. We found pretty good distribution along that whole vertical within the spat beds. The second question, yes, we have seen some evidence of spawning. And to me, that, again, relating back to the fire discussion before us, there's real potential to increase the supply of spat in the wild. One of the gentlemen in the back of the room is a lobsterman and a scallop dragger here at one of my sites, and he's watching very carefully. He's very enthusiastic that this is a way to increase spat settling in that area. And even if the spat doesn't settle there, we can grow them out. As you saw in the post-spat bag, only 2 to 3 months, you're talking about stuff that's a centimeter, centimeter and a half in diameter. We could, I'm sure, figure out ways to seed areas. And in conjunction with DMR and rotational dragging, build up the wild stock that way.
I was going to ask, on your rafts, so how far beneath, at what depth of water are you growing them out? Or doing the
this site's pretty, this site has a very muddy bottom. It's pretty flat. At mean low tide at the shallowest about 43 feet. So we're trying to stay 5 feet, for drainer tides, I'm sorry, but stay 5 feet off the bottom. And we're only about 4 feet below the surface. We were really concerned when we started with the ear hanging that it would be too choppy. So raft, we just took some space instead of having mussels there. And that raft can hold 40,000 pounds of mussels easily. I think when we put the first year with scallops on, there's only probably 20,000 pounds of mussels, so they're still going to move. The reach northeast is about 6 miles, so we've got great protection to the west and the northwest, but we get some pretty good shot coming out of the northeast on that. So that raft will move, and we were afraid that that would affect the growth. It doesn't seem to bother.
I didn't find that either.
No, and there are only 4 people in the circle.
I had a, down at the Darling Center, I don't know, was it 3 years ago when the Japanese came over, and I ended up, they didn't want to fly back with the stuff, so I managed to scoop it all up. And I had just a little lantern net, with, I don't know, 2 or 3 mil mesh in it, and I put some scallops in there that were very small and forgot about them and left them tied to John Spofford's dock down his diesel at about probably 18 inches beneath the water. And John, doing cleanup a couple weeks ago, found them, and I thought, well, they're no, that's, the lantern net was bulging out with the surviving scallops.
Yeah.
So here we're talking about the salinity has probably great variation. But at 18 inches beneath the surface, it's almost brackish water, and they didn't seem to give a shit. They're all cupped up like this, from overcrowding, but they only, they just constrained by the space. They're way more durable than what.
Absolutely, that's a great point, because that's what we found, too. We've left some intentionally in cages and not defiled them for 9 months. And you'll definitely have mortality. Some of the lower ones made mortality 30%, but we thought there'd be 100% mortality.
I think, when you look at that, according to the literature, it's like if you can, I can't remember what it was, let's say if you could get 50 spat or spat bag, that was more efficient than doing a hatchery thing. When Dane and I were on the Scallop Advisory Council together, and we were having an argument, or the fishermen were having an argument, of which I'm a fisherman too, but arguing that there's no spat. And so I called Mars then, and I thought, you know what, time's going by anyways, let's set some spat bag. And Mars said, I said, where? And he said, you know, draw a line from northeast to southwest along the main coast on the outer islands and set it there. And, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And he got 3,000 or 4,000 bat, you know, spat per bag. So that kind of answered the question for months. I mean, that's what I was looking at. So I can go back to the SAC and say, we don't have an issue with spat. We've got something else in the,
right,
you know, in the works. And back to your point about, and my observations about the crowding, is it is very labor intensive, but if we're getting 3,000 spat per bag, we may be able to sacrifice a portion of them to save the labor and put them in areas where,
right,
there are not, there are plenty of areas where that I put small scallops that stayed, but they wouldn't, there were no scallops there before because green crabs or starfish would eat them at, you know, prey upon them at a smaller size. But you get them to a certain size, it opens up a lot of possibilities.
And I'm going to give you some idea. So that's a 40 by 40 raft. And let's assume it's 45 feet of water, so our droppers are 40 feet long. You get a 400 single 40 foot droppers. We tie up both ends, we have about 200 droppers. You could have between 50 and 70,000 scallops floating around. I mean, that's in this very small amount of space. So, I mean,
yeah,
the potential is absolutely there. The next step is to, through information technology transfer and sharing information, learning how to mechanize and become efficient. And then the whole issue on the live sale, I think that's going to, I mean, I know from working with Allison, people at DMR, they really want any more years of data for their comfort one. Commentators in the industry, I think that's wise, because they do retain the right time for a long time. Any other questions?
I remember going to Mutsu Bay back in the early 90s with the original delegation that signed Sister of the Memorial. I think the hatcheries there and the whole thing was government subsidized, wasn't it? Isn't it?
It wasn't that he didn't gain it, probably could answer more. I know the fellow, it's not now wholly because the fellow that talking runs bimonthly, his family's been growing for 40 years now, and he also has a company that produces the machinery and the equipment. And I don't believe he's subsidized any further, but there's a lot of cooperative selling. A lot of there are big co-ops that buy, and so the prices there are quite, they're significantly lower for the farmer than what we would realize here. But any comment on where the industry stands now for subsidies in Japan? I don't know.
I could take a stab at it, and Steve was there on the trip in 99 and Hugh more recently as well, but my sense is that the fishing businesses themselves are not necessarily subsidized, but there's a lot of government cooperation and government support. So, for example, they'll set up spat collectors and they'll do larval surveys, and they have some pretty expensive oceanographic buoys. All of these things help to inform what's going on with the larval supply and to send out notices to the fishermen in an area, it's time to set your gear. Those kinds of things.
So, any questions? Yes, sir. And then come after. Yes, sir.
Is acidification a factor in all of your own species that
set? It could be. So far, it hasn't been. So, my partner Mark is one of the most knowledgeable people in Maine, certainly about acidification. And he studies that extensively. We haven't seen any issues, but this site is about a mile and a half offshore. And we're within 800 feet of that island, but you can see the background, that's Cumberland. And my understanding from Mark in general, in Maine right now, acidification is more issue than life. So clam larvae, things are settling in the mud. The scallops typically like a really hard bottom when they settle, and they're the places that I'm aware of around us are far enough out that there's been no evidence of that problem. Yes, ma'am.
My question is, when you're growing for the shop market, what do you do with the rest of the animal? And the reason why I'm asking is, it was recently suggested by someone to me that in the wild fishery where they shuck at sea, as they're required to do, the piles of tissue on the seafloor can be a way of spreading the biotoxins to other fisheries.
So I'm
just wondering if you had a plan for what
you
do with the rest of the animals
when you're shucking. No, the whole industry is very new. We're not there yet. I mean, we will have on those, we put down 21
lines this year, year on line, so there's only about 22,000, not even 1,500 animals. There are four other pilot farms. I don't think together there are 6,000 animals going on lines, maybe double that for cages. I'm not aware of anybody selling into the shark market at all. It's all very experimental now, so those are the kinds of questions that need to be addressed going forward. Anything else? Thank you very much.